WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. This is Deal Hudson, very special guest, one of my favorite people, Mary Beth Benacci. Mary Beth, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Deal, so much.
Do you mind if I tell our audience a little bit about you?
I don't mind at all.
Because there's a lot to tell, but I'm going to try to pare it down to essentials.
Right.
Mary Beth is known nationally, if not internationally, for her many lectures, her two books, her various video series. One of her books, Real Love, has been translated into 9 languages. On this topic of love, relationships, chastity, sex, and it's really remarkable that someone with a degree in philosophy from the University of San Francisco, St. Ignatius Institute, which in its day was one of the finest educational programs in the country, has been able to speak so engagingly to such a diverse group of people. She spoke at World Youth Day in Denver to 75,000 people. She's done that a long time, and she still does it, but she's also now in real estate in Denver and doing very well. Mary Beth, did that about sum it up?
That was beautiful, Deal. You're my agent from now on.
There you go.
If people want to know about me, I'm going to have them call you.
Please do. I want to ask you that is the message that you communicated for so long and still do, am I wrong in saying that it's needed now more than ever?
Oh, no, you're not wrong at all. Absolutely.
What's going on out there?
It's getting so lost in this kind of politically correct atmosphere. My concern from the beginning when I first started speaking was this kind of pervasive redefinition of love, that love no longer means what it means, which is seeing the image and likeness of God in the person and wanting what is best for them. And the redefinitions of love, of hate, where love becomes anything that makes you happy in the moment, for me to want that for you, that's what loving you is to give you license. And hate is any sort of disagreement, any sort of different thought. That politically correct thought has run so amok, and it's getting more and more difficult to be heard through the noise of that.
Well, I remember what the 60s and 70s and 80s were like, because I lived through them, and I was in my salad days, as it's often said. But I raised a daughter who's now 26, so I watched a young woman grow up in the 90s and now in the first decade of the 21st century. And I'm raising a son who's now in 10th grade, so I'm getting it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And my impression is that it's nearly impossible to not be confronted with just the rawness, most raw view and understanding of human relationships, particularly sexual relationships. But you're really saying it all begins with what we think love is.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because that's how I found that I could get through. When I first started giving these talks, I first started working primarily with teenagers, and no one believed, the adults didn't believe the teenagers would listen. The teenagers.
I bet they believe now.
Exactly. And the key I found was talking about love, because that's what they're hungry for. And if you can get past all of the, they're going to do it anyway, they're just animals, and really tap into, you want love, you're hungry for love, and describe what it is, and give them this idea that, yeah, that is, I may not have even been aware of it, but that is what I've been hungry for.
Let's go back to this attitude of they're going to do it anyway, because I hear that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't the attitude when I was growing up. The attitude when I was growing up was, you can exert self-control. You have responsibility over yourself. Is that completely gone?
It's a lot harder to find. I used to always say, when I was talking to the teens, they were rather insulted by it once we kind of walked through things a while. People say you're going to do it anyway, and I said, here's what I think. Cattle are going to do it anyway. That's why we don't have little, you know, we don't give little talks to cattle. We don't stay over on that.
You don't have a video for cattle?
I don't.
No cattle videos? What about squirrels, walruses?
For me, I really believe they're going to do it anyway.
That's right.
Which is why we perform a very crude form of surgery on them. But the whole idea is that we are supposed to be capable of better, and we're supposed to be capable of self-control, and that idea is so lost.
Well, why does true love, or real love as you call it, require self-control?
Because we cannot look out for what's best for the other and what's best for ourselves and simultaneously follow any passing appetite that happens to come by. Because our appetites, being disordered as they are, will in many cases be contrary to what is best for the other, and indeed what is best for our own selves.
Well, let me ask you a philosophical question, since you studied with some pretty good philosophers and theologians along the way, and I'm sure you've kept up with Aristotle and Aquinas.
Regularly I pull them out.
Speaking of passing appetites, is it possible ever to eliminate altogether passing appetites?
It's an interesting question, and one that has gotten a lot of airplay recently in certain circles. John Paul II was clear that in the theology of the body that, well, the goal is to constantly strive to overcome concupiscence, or really more likely to strive
to allow
the Holy Spirit.
Everybody what concupiscence is.
Yes, the passing appetites are disordered.
It's the embrace of the passing appetite. The tasting and the devouring of the appetite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the holier we become, the more our appetites become ordered. But John Paul II was clear that we don't get back to Eden. Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. before original sin, their appetites were perfectly ordered, and even with perfectly ordered appetites, they still managed to mess up. But before sin entered the world, look between them was a look of absolute love. Your creator.
Maybe Adam was perfectly ordered. Maybe Adam. But Eve couldn't have been, or she wouldn't have succumbed to the serpent.
Yeah, and the question is, was that a result of appetite, or was that a pure intellectual, you make a point, the apple was attractive, and it was attractive to her, but the sin was pure, you will be like God. It was an intellectual decision. It was, if I don't believe that he is Father. I don't believe that when he tells me that he wants what is best for me.
So Adam's sin in taking the apple from Eve was less of a sin than Eve's taking it from the serpent.
Well, I suppose you could argue that.
I mean, if her sin was the sin of Milton Satan, you know, the great denial of God, and I will defy you, and I will be my own God. Did Adam take it from Eve with the same intention?
I don't know if we know that. Really, all it says is she gave it to him and he ate it, right? So
I think that's right, but, you know, we'll talk to Jeff Cavins and some people
that
later on. Going back, see, what I wanted you to talk about is what happens when you allow the appetites to run wild. What happens to the appetites themselves? Do they become stronger? Do they become more powerful? What happens?
They become stronger and more powerful, and also less satisfying. So there's the law of diminishing returns. When the appetites run wild, we become less satisfied with what, I mean, not that it was ever satisfying, but because it's never satisfying, there's this hunger for more and more and more.
Could you also use the phrase less pleasurable?
Yes, that would be good.
So to indulge the appetites, and of course we're talking now pure Epicurus, pure Stoicism. all the Stoics and Epicureans, even though Epicureans are thought to be people who indulge themselves, they didn't. The point is that to indulge an appetite is to diminish the rewards of acting on it, correct?
Absolutely.
Is this why sensualists turn into bored skeptics, bored and sort of slothful ne'er-do-wells? What is the end of the road for a sensualist?
I mean, you want to say it's the desire for self-annihilation, really. It gets to a point where nothing satisfies, nothing, it's bored, it's disillusioned, it's disgusted.
Well, what's the connection of tattoos? I mean, I really have a problem with this. And I told my daughter if she ever got a tattoo, she'd be disinherited. Talking to Mary Beth Benacci about sex, love, and other matters, chastity among human beings, but especially among young adults, is the rage for tattoos in any way connected to what we're talking about?
I think you could probably make an argument that there's a certain, the body isn't good enough as it is. The body is supposed to be an expression of the self. We are embodied souls. We are ensouled bodies. And the idea that we are male and female and that this, our maleness and our femaleness expresses the interior and the exterior, the fact that sexual love in its proper context is a total self-giving, a total expression of the self, a total donation of the self. When you start to lose that, I guess you've got to get creative with the body. How does my body only expresses me if I can make it a canvas?
Do we still have the phenomenon of young women who cut themselves? Is that still going on?
Oh, yeah.
What's behind that in terms of appetite, satisfaction, not satisfaction? Are they connected?
I think the way I've always seen cutting is as kind of a release, there's this inability to sufficiently release the level of pain that they're experiencing, and they somehow feel that cutting themselves, there's clearly a self-loathing element to it too, to turn on the body and to attack the body that way.
What is the equivalent among young men? What are young men doing that they're acting out the same kind of narrative?
Probably just what occurs to me first is just the extreme risk taking.
The drugs?
Yeah, the drugs, the driving three times the speed limit.
Right, the drag races.
Yeah, the drinking to unconsciousness, the drugs, the stupid risks.
Yeah, and the kind of behavior that's fed by drinking and by drugs and by the culture, kind of the Justin Bieber mm-hmm. model of how to enjoy your life if you've got all the money you ever wanted to have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it becomes clear that having all the money you ever wanted to have isn't particularly enjoyable in the end.
But is your message welcome? Let me backtrack. Here you are, someone who for a while now, at least as long as I've known you and you've known me, we've been talking about similar things, overlapping things. You come to a culture that is as sensual as any on record, I think perhaps even more than in Roman times or Greek times. And everything is allowed, even in mass media, even on the Family Hour on television, mm-hmm. this is formerly sacred. And the advertisements of clothing, of drinks, of whatever, are all about the appeal of sensuality.
Mm-hmm.
But you're coming in and saying exactly the opposite. You're not really. You're saying, look, there's nothing wrong with sexual appetite, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not the way to do it. There's another way to do it. But you're also saying it's more satisfying and more pleasurable.
And
is that correct?
Key.
How can you possibly convince somebody of that?
There are two ways to convince. One, and it's almost easier if you can get the person who has actually experienced the other and has experienced the isolation and the loneliness and is sufficiently disillusioned with what is happening. Those people, provided they're ready to let go, can be reached. Because I've always said, this great hunger for love that is built within us, most of what's going on, most of the promiscuity, the sexual license, is really at its very base, at least I'll certainly say among women, fueled by that hunger for love. And if you just come in and say, no, 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 don't have sex because you're going to get a disease, because you're going to get pregnant, because these bad things will happen, if you haven't shown them, they're in it looking for love. Somehow, on some deep level, that's the need they're trying to fill. And unless you show them where else they can fill that need, all of the scare tactics in the world aren't going to work. I don't care if I get a disease. I don't care if I'm risking my own life. Unless you show me, if this is the only place I've got to find love, I'm going to keep looking there.
Well, I'm talking to Mary Beth Bonacci. This is Deal Hudson about, it's called Sex, Love, and Relationships Among Young People, but some young people who are now reaching middle age. Tell us a story, don't name names, mm-hmm. about someone you know, a woman, who was cruising along, indulging her appetites, looking for love, and then one day woke up and realized that everything she was doing was working against her happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell a story like that?
I mean, it's going to be a composite because I can't think of...
Make a composite. How does that... This obviously happens, correct?
It does. It does.
There are lots of women who wake up and they're 35 or they're 38 mm-hmm. and they say, I don't have any kids. I may have had a couple of abortions. I've had serial men living with me or me with them. Nobody, all these fiancés I have fallen through, et cetera, et cetera. What have I done wrong?
Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, there are two ways. Sometimes if it'll happen in the context of one of my talks or in the context of reading something where a real aha light goes off, and then it's, why didn't anyone ever tell me this? And there's a certain betrayal. A lot of times the aha is much more gradual where, okay, this isn't working, something isn't working, I'm really unhappy, but because I don't have the right answer, I don't really know who to blame. So then it becomes kind of a trial and error where a lot of times I really believe that this is the basis of a lot of lesbianism.
Because Explain that a little further.
All of that disillusionment, then all of that, oh my gosh, this didn't work. I didn't get what I was looking for. I'm unhappy. I've had abortions. I'm grieving my children. I've been hurt by men. It's men. And whether it's going to be lesbianism or just that kind of stereotypical middle-aged bitter woman syndrome of, I have been hurt, men were involved in it, therefore it's men's fault, therefore men are bad. And whether I'm going to turn away from them entirely and turn to women, I'm not saying that's the only basis for lesbianism, but I think it's one factor for some women. Or whether it's just going to be, I just quit the whole thing. But you get among a lot of middle-aged women, a very bitter vibe toward men. And I feel very badly for the good men who had no part.
Are there good men, Mary Beth?
There are. I haven't found one to marry yet. But there are.
And I want to ask about the other group, which is much smaller, the group of women, whether they're for Catholic reasons, Christian reasons, kind of just deep moral reasons, who have not gone the way of living with boyfriends or sleeping out first date or second date, who have created limits that probably surprise the men that they meet.
Oh, yeah.
And the men that like them. What is their fate?
You can't assign a single fate for all of them, but for many, and I mean right now at least, I am in this category, there is a cross to be carried, which is if part of your vision of marriage is someone who shares your faith and not just the name on the baptismal certificate, but actual a living understanding, a living acceptance and participation in the Catholic faith, there are a lot fewer men, and I'm sure there are probably for men they have this same more difficult struggle in finding women, but I think more for women, the cross is a life of singleness. If there's no willingness to compromise that, and if there are so fewer men who embrace that to choose from, then the cross is not having marriage, not having a family.
By the way, I've got a few friends who waited till their 30s to get married, and they actually decided not to marry Catholics because all the Catholics they met with or dated, you know, wanted to jump into the sack right away.
Exactly, and that's the difference between just sharing, having the baptismal certificate that says you're part of the crew, and actually living the active faith.
Well, she met a non-Catholic, I won't tell you what faith or anything, who was an extremely upright guy, and
yeah,
who was just thrilled to find someone like her.
Yeah.
So what? And she always thought she would marry a Catholic, but she said to herself, look, I've been playing it right for all these years. This is the kind of man I've always looked for. He's a devout person, a good, ethically good person. I'm going to say yes.
And the thing is, that's a good option as well. And really, I mean, I should have made that clear when I was saying not necessarily a Catholic, but someone who just shares a basic moral foundation. And I think in my parents' generation, that moral foundation was much more universal. I mean, wherever you went, even if someone wasn't necessarily Catholic, because society upheld those same values, you could pretty much bet that who.
Well, there was a culture of shame in those
exactly.
days, which I'm not sure wasn't destructive in its own way. I remember what happened to Ingrid Bergman when she married the Italian filmmaker Roberto Rossellini, and they both, I think she broke up as his marriage.
Uh-huh.
She became complete persona non grata in the United States, one of the country's most beloved actresses. But the first, by the way, just for the sake of a history lesson, the first actress to do those kinds of things publicly and get away with it was Elizabeth Taylor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is the line of demarcation in sort of cultural history between the culture of shame and the culture of, okay, that as long as they're happy.
Yeah.
As long as they're happy.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. We went from extreme to extreme. And, I mean, this is why we needed Vatican II, was because I think we had a very empty, it became increasingly empty. It became increasingly exterior, increasingly, well, you don't do that because what will the neighbors say? You don't do that because there was no real philosophical underpinning behind it. And so in the 60s, it's like the hippies just suddenly said, well, if this is so empty, and so if the only reason you can give me is what will the neighbors say, then I reject that reason, and I'm going to throw out all your mores. And I mean,
by the way, I'm talking to Mary Beth Bonacci about sex, love, and relationships, and now ethics and morality. Did you know my first teaching position was in the state and federal penitentiaries in Atlanta, Georgia?
I did not know that.
And my first class in the state penitentiary was ethics, and we read Aristotle's Ethics.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was a life-changing experience because around the second or third class, I noticed them looking at each other and giggling. And we were getting along fine. I mean, they liked me. I would do push-ups when they asked me a question that I couldn't answer and so mm-hmm. forth. And so I said, okay, guys, why are you laughing? And the one guy in there who pretty articulate just said, you know, Dr. Hudson, we like you and we're enjoying the class, but all of us believe the only reason people talk about ethics or even act as if they want to be ethical is order to make an impression on another person, to be trusted by that person, and to be successful in their occupation and in their life. In other words, it's all
show.
A sham.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That there was nobody was sincere mm-hmm. about wanting to embody those virtues. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a real eye opener for me.
It would be.
Because I had never met that kind of pure cynicism before. I mean, is it something you've become familiar with?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I've seen it in that pure a form. I think it's much more a mixed bag. I think people are hungry to find that authentically, and I think the more they've been hurt, the less faith they have that it exists.
Well, when we come back from the other side of the break, I'm going to tell you how I dealt with it in the class the following week. I came up with a little, you might say, parable, which I told them and asked them to react. Now, I'll ask you the parable, and I'll ask you to react. So we'll just test you like I tested them. How about that? I'm talking with Mary Beth Bonacci, a very well-known speaker on love, sex, chastity, relationships, and all that goes with it. Once again, we've only got a few minutes left in this segment. You talk about love in order to deal with the questions of sex and appetites and all the sins that, you know, trip people up. And you're saying that men respond to that. How do they get outside of themselves to respond to that?
I don't know if they have to get outside of themselves as much as they have to get deeper inside of themselves to see that what they're really longing for is the vision that I put forth, the vision that has always been the church's vision, that you have a dignity, that you are loved individually, that sex has a meaning, and that meaning is good and holy and awesome and protects us from all of the damage that
so it speaks
experience.
It just speaks directly to the human heart.
Exactly.
I'm speaking with Mary Beth Bonacci, who has a very big heart. This is Deal Hudson. You're listening to Church and Culture. We'll be back in just a moment.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
1 in 3 Americans deal directly or indirectly with alcohol or substance abuse in their lifetime. If you're dependent and contemplating help, start listening to Renewing Hope every Saturday at noon on Ave Maria Radio. Renewing Hope is an information gateway to overcoming dependency. Brought to you by the St. Gregory Retreat Center, they want to help. Send your comments and questions without obligation to Renewing Hope at AveMariaRadio.net. And all audio archives can be found at our website at AveMariaRadio.net.
Christ the King Church in Ann Arbor titled their parish mission, Lord, That We Might See, the glory and majesty of the Church, and our call to form in ourselves a Catholic worldview. Father Ed Friede spoke the first evening.
We have, each of us, a particular worldview. We've been formed in it since we, as little children, began to absorb the reality of the universe around us. It is hardwired into us to know. In fact, Aristotle came to the conclusion that the human soul must be immortal because its desire to know could never be satisfied by just one life here. Not bad for a pagan.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Listen to Seeing Things Jesus' Way, Turning the World Right Side Up on Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. This is Deal Hudson. I'm talking with Mary Beth Bonacci, very well-known, nationally known speaker, writer, maker of videos on issues involving love, sex, chastity, relationships. I was talking in the earlier segment, Mary Beth, about my prison students in Georgia at the State Pen who laughed at me teaching Aristotle because their argument was that no one really wants to be good or be virtuous. They only want to give the impression of it in order to succeed with other people. Mm-hmm. So I came back and told him, I asked him to consider this story, and I'll ask you to consider it. You're on a desert island. You're alone. You have all the things on that island that you need, not just survive, but to live well. You have all the food. You have all the water. You have medical care. You have every single thing that you need, but there are no other people. And this is what's important. There's no God.
Mm-hmm.
There's no God. One day, you have a machete in your hand, and you get the impulse to lay your arm across a stump and chop your hand off. Could that be considered, in that universe, a morally wrong thing to do, an evil thing to do? You're doing it to yourself, and there's nobody around to watch, and there's no God to judge, but you're going to lop your own hand off. Is that, could we make the argument that that's an evil act?
For me, the key comes down to there is no God. I mean, it's hard to place the mind in that space.
It's hard to place your mind in that space.
Exactly. Our minds live there. But
we still have human nature in play, Mary Beth.
Mm-hmm.
We still have the essence. We still have the person.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, what I'm dealing with are people who say, look, if I'm only hurting myself, that's
mm-hmm.
my choice.
Mm-hmm. It's my body. It's my choice.
I'm not affecting anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that example to argue that how you treat yourself is a moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, morality just doesn't begin with the other person.
Mm-hmm.
It begins with how you treat yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people think of the moral relationship that we have just to ourselves, and that's what you're always talking about, that because
exactly
of the choices people are making about relationships, right?
Exactly. And it's so much easier to discuss in a faith-based environment where you can say, God created you, God loved you, God redeemed you. You carry this absolute inherent dignity. And this is where I got into this discussion of real love and pizza love that I've found people of all ages respond to so well, is because love has come to really be using. I love you, I love the places you take me, I love the way you make me feel about myself, I love the gifts you give me. And I tell them, I love my nieces and nephews, crazy about them. I'm willing to sacrifice for them anywhere, anytime to make sure they're okay. That's what I mean when I say I love my nieces and nephews. When I say I love pizza, I'm just saying I eat it for my own enjoyment. I don't care what happens to the pizza. And I tell them next time someone says I love you, look very deeply into their eyes and say, would that be pizza love or real thing? Because real love recognizes, if someone loves me, they recognize my dignity. They respect my dignity. They're not going to put me at any risk. They're not going to use me as just a means to their satisfaction in whatever realm without caring what happens to me. And I tell them, you cannot have healthy relationship until you have a healthy sense of yourself and a healthy self-love, which is not I love pie and therefore I get all the pie. But is I carry a dignity, and I am loved by God, and you being allowed to love me, you being allowed into my orbit, requires that you recognize that and you respect that as I respect you and the image and likeness of God in you. That's the essence of love.
Let me really put you on the spot.
All right.
Pretend you're my student, and we're in the state women's penitentiary,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, would have never happened. But... And then you're saying to me, you're insisting, regardless of my story about being on the desert island, that I can do anything to myself I want, and it's not a moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask you, well, is how you treat another person a moral issue? And you say what?
I would assume I say yes.
Yes, okay. And then I ask you, why does it matter how you treat another person? What's your answer?
I'm trying to channel my inner prison self.
Because Because they're a person.
Yeah, because they're another person.
They have dignity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the coup de grace question is, aren't you a person?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, yeah. And then I ask you, well, why wouldn't you treat yourself with the same respect that you would treat another person?
Mm-hmm.
That got them.
I
must say, I converted a few in the classroom on
mm-hmm.
that.
Good for you.
Because I show them that the ground, the same ground that they might consider treating other people well, exists between themselves as agents toward themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, this self-destructive tendency that people have, you know, they talk about the sense of self and the sense of, the, you know, ego strength and so forth. Do you think part of the problem is that people just don't understand their own lives, their own individual lives, in terms of moral development?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just kind of a floating along from pleasure to pleasure.
And trying not to hurt other people at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a very narrow, and this is why this moral argument, you know, now that we've legalized marijuana in Colorado, there's a whole lot of crazy argumentation going on.
I forgot to pick on you about that.
I was listening to a radio show the other day, and this guy called in and thought he had just come up with the greatest moral argument, and it was basically, if I'm sitting in my basement smoking pot, how does that hurt you? And it's all morality has come down to, if myself doing this in this very moment doesn't hurt yourself doing this in this very moment, therefore it must be moral.
There is just no sense of there's no sense of the spiritual connection of people.
None.
You know, John Donne's "No man is an island unto himself."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was born in Denver.
Were you?
Did you know that? Yes.
I don't think I knew that.
I was born in the Catholic Hospital in Denver 64 years ago. And it saddens me, frankly, that a great state, great community, would make such a silly and destructive legislative decision.
Oh, trust me. It saddens me as well, and it's my fervent prayer that we get smart and reverse this. But
then you have President Obama saying that smoking pot is no worse than drinking beer.
Yeah, so that was very surprising to me because he clearly hadn't consulted his own White House website.
What does the website say, Mary
Beth? Oh, my gosh, the website has a whole extensive section on the dangers of marijuana.
Does it really?
Yeah. I mean, it did. It may be gone now.
And, I mean, I grew up, you know, I had college roommates at the University of Texas who smoked pot, and one young man's life was ruined
mm-hmm.
by marijuana, the marijuana habit that lasted all the way into his adult life, his married life, his business life. He became a different person, as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that alarms me is, I mean, I saw that in my high school as well, but from what I'm reading now, today's marijuana is significantly stronger. What am I seeing? 4 to 5 times stronger than the pot that was floating around when we were young.
Well, I'm a little older than you are, so I'll give you a decade or so. But talking to Mary Beth Bonacci about chastity. Now, what is chastity, by the way? I mean, is chastity simply never touching and never being touched? What is
no.
it?
No. Chastity, as I've defined it in my talks, is simply respecting the language that God built into human sexuality. Respecting that sex, the sexual act, sexual intercourse, and the activity around it speaks a language. It says, I give myself to you, and everything is about it is oriented to that. So in that context, it's incredible. It makes sense. It speaks a language honestly. And I think it's a very important concept because if you just start the abstinence message, just don't do it, just don't do it, just don't do it, you wind up kind of inadvertently giving the message that somehow sex is bad. And I found that when I first started giving these talks and I was using kind of a problem-solution model and I was still working with teenagers. And so I did the problem. And, you know, whenever you're giving a talk, the first half of the talk takes the first 90% of the time. So when I'm
right.
giving a very negative talk about all these problems, all these bad things that could happen, and the ideas that I'd come in halfway through and say, here's the answer, chastity, yay, God's plan. But I'd spent so much time on the negative that I had a kid come up to me afterwards, I think it was a written feedback said this was a very good talk and helped me understand why I will not ever have sex. And I think we need to make a change here. I've done my job a little too well.
And could you address this misunderstanding that I think continues to crop up when people talk about the Catholic Church, about priests and nuns and so forth? That how can priests and nuns and people who have given up sexual expression in the sense of, you know, intercourse and so forth, how can they know anything about what we are going through out here?
You know, the funny thing is, I find it much more dangerous to have to get advice from someone who is in the midst of it themselves, because their experience is going to be so narrowly limited to their own experience. Their tendency is going to be to project whatever they have experienced in their marriage, which is not your marriage, which is not this other person's marriage. But if they're basing it on their own personal experience, their advice is going to be extraordinarily narrow. Whereas you look at a John Paul II, who spent his entire life befriending and advising and counseling, starting with his own good friends and going out from there, tens to hundreds to thousands of married couples, A, there's a much broader base to work from. B, there's this incredible sanctity of being connected to God and understanding what this message really is. I mean, really, I think it's a much better position to be someone who's seeing it from that broader perspective than someone who's just saying, well, in my marriage, we tried this.
And well, also from the perspective of someone who has denied something that other people don't deny and who had the strength of self-control and actually looks at it from the perspective of someone who felt the desire, felt the appetite, but was able to restrain themselves. I mean, doesn't that give you a certain knowledge about it?
Exactly. They say, what is stronger, the tree that stands up to the wind or the tree that snaps in the wind?
It sounds like an allusion to John the Baptist.
Yeah, yes.
What did you think you were coming to, a reed shaking in the breeze?
A reed shaking in the
I don't know why I did a Scottish accent on that, but
I'm
talking to Mary Beth Bonacci about love, sex, marriage, chastity, and the world, the cultural world that our young adults, our teenagers live in. What about pornography? When I was a kid, the only thing we had was Playboys, and we hid them under rocks in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have anything else.
You didn't have the guts to go to the drugstore and buy it.
No, I didn't. I didn't have the guts to do that. And I was not McLovin. I didn't have the guts to go in and buy booze, you know, with a fake ID. So talk about the impact of this incredible accessibility of porn on the Internet to just kids, that any kid that gets on the Internet.
I just saw a story yesterday. I didn't have the stomach to read the story. I only read the headline of a 13-year-old boy who pled guilty after seeing porn and then deciding to try it out on his 8-year-old sister. How do these kids know? How can they even build a moral foundation when what they're exposed to is so degraded and so it? The thing about the way God wired us sexually is that it imprints, it touches us at the very deepest levels of who we are. It's not just something extrinsically done with the body that the spirit and the soul and the brain can check out. It's intimately linked, and when it becomes depersonalized like that, when it just becomes about my satisfaction, when it becomes, it's this kind of, it means I'm not faceless, they have a face, but this person upon whom I can project anything, who's then this whole experience is just about my own personal satisfaction, it destroys the ability to give, to have self-gift
and to receive
a loving environment in a marriage.
What is, you know, I asked you earlier, what is the sort of end game for the sensualist? What's the end game for the porn at, for the someone who can't free themselves from porn?
It takes more and more to, I mean, it, like I said, it never satisfies. But it takes more and more to even excite, to even give pleasure, and that's the danger.
And that can get into a marriage, right?
Oh, yes. I cannot tell you how much correspondence I've received, largely from wives, who were just devastated that their husband preferred porn to the marriage.
How did they even know about it?
They found out one way or another, at least the ones who wrote me, they knew. But I think even if you don't know, you probably sense something is wrong, because this kind of selfish orientation of porn, which is at its base, I mean, this is about satisfying me. There's no other real person involved in the experience. It destroys the ability to turn it into a giving.
Is your observation that married men who get deeply into porn start ignoring their wives?
Oh, yeah.
They do?
Yeah. Yeah, because they become incapable. It's like, it's a completely separate substance. The loving sexual expression of a husband and wife is so fundamentally different from the self-absorbed experience of pornography. And sex, the way we're wired is we become very, very conditioned, and the things that stimulate us early on tend to become necessary. And
so we repeat the behavior.
Exactly. Exactly. And you're
talking to Mary Beth Bonacci about love, sex, marriage, relationships, and now pornography. Have you ever looked into the neuroscience that is relevant to pornography?
I have some, probably not enough to be considered an expert.
Me neither, but there is this notion of mirroring that the brain, whatever it sees, evidently 75% of the brain is given over to visual stimuli. Whatever the brain sees, it can mirror into itself as if they are doing what it sees. So somebody watching pornography, some feel down deep inside in some dark place that they're actually a participant in what they're watching. Is that correct?
That makes sense.
They actually feel they're there. I mean, this is why you come out of a movie like Braveheart and you feel like you can take somebody down. Because you're so identified with the hero. And I think the same kind of thing is going on with pornography. There's a fantasy world. You feel like a man. You feel like a great lover, or you feel like beautiful women want you. It's very seductive. I feel extremely sympathetic as a healthy male. I think I am anyway. I feel extremely sympathetic with men who have fallen into this.
I think it's so important.
I in no way judge them. I in no way I'm criticizing them. I'm just saying, look for help. Admit it to somebody. Confess it to somebody. Don't keep it a secret. And just say, please help me. That's all you need to do. That's the first step.
Then there is help. And there are more and more ministries cropping up because so many men, I mean, through so little fault of their own, because it's so pervasive and so easy to get.
It's two clicks away.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, yeah, I think it needs to be acknowledged how widespread this problem is, and that there is help, and that really at its root, it's in confession, it's in grace, it's in, but there's a lot of actual work that needs to be done as well, but it's a reorienting with the Holy Spirit.
Do women have the same level of problem with pornography that men do?
No. And every time, it's funny, because every time I write a column for Catholic Match, and every time I write something on pornography, the men get all mad at me and say, well, what about women? Women use porn, too. And I think you're getting increasing numbers of women using porn because of this kind of breaking down of the distinction between men and women trying to be like men. But women aren't as naturally predisposed to it because we aren't visually oriented in the same way men are. We're just wired differently. And so while I think you have increasing numbers because women aren't completely immune to it. But
well, I, for one, am glad you're wired differently.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I know men are wired pretty weirdly. And I do think for men that attractiveness and desire stimulation is so much more mental than it is physical, tactile.
Mm-hmm.
It's visual. Evidently, a man decides within a seventh of a second if a woman's walking down the street whether or not that woman is sexually attractive to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a glimpse, just a blink.
Mm-hmm.
And they've decided. I don't think women do it that way. Am I wrong?
No, oh, no, no. John Gray wrote, John Gray, as a secular,
he's not off base.
He got a lot of stuff right.
Yeah, he was a Catholic guy from Houston, by the way.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
He's a good Texan there.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about the levels of attraction, and for women, physical is about, I think third out of four, and it's true.
Do you remember what the top two are?
Oh, it's intellectual, I don't remember the exact, but first you get to know them, and it's kind of, is there kind of a compatibility here? Do I like this person's personality? And then you kind of get deeper into beliefs, and it takes a while for a woman. I mean, and he says if a woman is attracted to a man immediately on all four levels, she should run. Because that's
it's interesting because on television now, in any given sitcom or even drama, you have all these scenes where women look at a guy from across the room and their eyes light up, and
mm-hmm.
she'll lean over to her girlfriend and say, oh, he's hot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that really happen?
Well, I mean, you can recognize someone as being attractive, but I think for a woman who hasn't gone too far down the road into unchaste behavior, there's a big difference between recognizing someone as attractive and actually wanting to be physically intimate with them.
Isn't it possible?
The same way, it's like recognizing, beautiful art.
Right. I mean, isn't it possible just to enjoy the presence of somebody who has charismatic or is particularly beautiful or is particularly well-dressed? And isn't it possible just to enjoy that and not have to own it?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the sense that is lost. And I think for women, you can say, that's an attractive person, but it doesn't immediately go to, I want to be intimate with that. I think because women have much more at stake. Women, just the way we're built, women get pregnant, women get diseases more.
We have a few minutes left, Mary Beth, and there's been one question I've always wanted to ask you, and I'm going to ask it now. And it's somewhat in line with what we've been talking about. I have noticed, and I live near Washington, D.C., and I go to New York City quite a bit because my daughter lives there, but I notice when I'm walking down the street and some woman, lovely woman, comes by who is particularly undressed, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Now all the women are wearing black tights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there doesn't seem to be pants or skirts anymore. It's all tights. But the more audaciously dressed, the more revealing, the less they look around, they keep their eyes dead ahead, and the more invaded they feel by any attention. In other words, if you get mm-hmm. their eye or if you say you're looking good, which I don't do, by the way. But,
hey,
but I find
good.
That they are the most offended if some man responds to how they're looking, and they're looking provocative.
Yeah.
What's going on?
It's a very strange dichotomy, and I don't think I could fully psychoanalyze it, except that you dress that way if you want attention. But I think there's this lack of understanding, and young girls certainly do this, is because they watch Sex and the City and whatever, and this is, young girls want to be attractive to boys. That's just how it's natural, and what I'm always trying to get across to them is there are different kinds of attention. There's loving attention, there's I'd like to get to know her better, and there's using attention, which is those parts call out to me and I would like to have access to them.
Going to have to bring our conversation to a close. Will you come back and talk to me again?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mary Beth Bonatti, for being my guest on Church and Culture, Steele Hudson. I promise everyone out there who has enjoyed this as much as I have that Mary Beth will be a regular part of this show. As we close, I want to thank each of you for listening. I hope you found it as enjoyable as I have in bringing it to you. Join me again next week on Church and Culture, brought to you by Ave Maria Radio.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
When we wonder where God is during challenging times, we can turn to King David for inspiration. After being chosen by God to be king, he spent years on the run. Yet in Psalm 37, David writes, "Fret not yourselves because of evildoers. Trust in the Lord and befriend faithfulness." When we trust in God and befriend faithfulness, we have confidence in our relationship with God. Thus David can say in Psalm 26, "Prove me, O Lord, and try me, for I walk in your faithfulness." This confidence overflows in Psalm 31. The Lord preserves the faithful. Be strong, let your heart take courage, all you who wait on the Lord. By David's example, we know we can hold fast to our faith and trust that God is with us. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan, www.cbsmich.org.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. C.S. Lewis famously wrote that we are secret agents behind enemy lines. It's true. This world is under hostile rule, and its prince is in full-scale rebellion against our Father in heaven, with a mission to take as many souls with him as possible. Our mission, should we choose to accept it, is to raid and poach in Satan's territory and rescue souls out from under him. We should not be surprised or dismayed at opposition. Of course Satan will work to stop us, but we have a clear promise that we are equipped and commissioned to do the job. We are called to attack the kingdom of the world and rescue souls in bondage to the world, the flesh, and the devil, and bring them to our Father's heavenly kingdom. Are you ready?
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Faith, family, and the culture of life. It's Family Man with Catholic therapist Dr. Gregory Popchak.
In reflecting on my own reactions to life's pressures, as well as observing the effect of conflict and tension in the lives of my clients, I've noticed something. Stress makes us selfish. The more stressed we become, the more obsessed we become with how busy we are, how tired we are, how overwhelmed we are, and how much we need time to ourselves. The irony is, it's often the point where we feel like we're working so hard to live up to everyone else's expectations, that's the point where we start becoming most selfish. But here's the good news. Nothing serves as a more effective antidote to stress than strong relationships. The more we feel connected to God and the people who love us, the less likely we are to get lost in ourselves, as the pressure from the outside world makes us want to circle our emotional wagons. If you've been feeling the tension in your life building lately, take some time to connect with the others in your life. Remind yourself that being too busy for God and family means being too busy. I'm Dr. Gregory Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
You've been listening to Family Man with Catholic therapist Dr. Gregory Popchak. To discover more resources for living an abundant life, including books, CDs, and Catholic counseling services, visit us online at exceptionalmarriages.com.
And now a word of encouragement from Mark Shea at CatholicExchange.com.
There is a story of a missionary and his son who returned from overseas aboard a ship that was carrying a famous movie star. When the ship pulled into New York,